2 Corinthians chapter 8. 2 Corinthians 8. 2 Corinthians 8 and 9 definitely hang together around one subject. And the one subject they revolve about is the grace of giving. And both chapters deal with it. They in turn, if you look through your New American Standard text, divide into three paragraphs. The first one is in 8, 1 through 15, and the emphasis is directed toward the Corinthian church that you need to learn to be generous. Then in chapter 8, verse 16, the next paragraph goes through chapter 9 and verse 5, and the emphasis is on the messenger that is going to help you to be generous, and his name is Titus. Then the final chapter or paragraph is 9, 6 through 15, and the emphasis will be on the results of this generosity. So we begin with the grace of giving, and number one, the need for generosity. And we use that word generosity on purpose, and I think as we go through the study, you'll see why. Because generous giving is going to be the emphasis, and it is 8, 1 through 15, and that in turn divides into two parts. First, the example of it. Second, the plea for it. One, the example of it, verses 1 through 5. Reading. Now, brethren, we wish to make known to you the grace of God which was given in the churches of Macedonia, that in a great ordeal of affliction, their abundance of joy and their deep poverty overflowed in the wealth of their liberality. And then he gives more details about them. But basically, as he sits in front of the Corinthian church, he will sit in front of them the example of generosity. And we have, first of all, their identity. Who were the people that were the example of generosity? Notice in verse 1, they were the churches of Macedonia. As far as we know from the text of Scripture, the churches of Macedonia were three. It took in the church at Philippi. It took in the church at Berea. And it took in the church at Thessalonica. All of those are Macedonia churches. And the interesting thing about each one of these churches is that there is a remarkable spiritual quality associated with each one of them. For example, in Acts 17, it talks about the nobility of the church at Berea because they always verified things by going to the Scriptures. Thessalonica was commended because they received the Word of God in the middle of affliction in a remarkable way. Philippi was recognized as having a unique spiritual quality, and then when Paul went and left Macedonia, they were the only single church that supported him. So the church at Philippi, Berea, and Thessalonica are now going to be set in front of the church at Corinth as the example of generosity. That's their identity. Next, he points to their blessing. And that is found in verse 1. And the important thing to note is this. The giving of the churches of Macedonia is not presented as something they have achieved. Paul is not talking about what they have done. It is not described in terms of, did you see what the churches of Macedonia did? Have you noted what they accomplished? Have you noted how they gave? Notice the way it is described. It is not described as something they have done. It is described as a divine enablement. So we have in verse 1, now brethren, we wish to make known to you the grace of God which has been given. And so the emphasis, which is of tremendous importance here in terms of principle, is simply the fact that giving is not an achievement. Giving is an enablement. He does not present it as an achievement, but is an enablement. It was God's grace that enabled them to give. It was not an achievement that they accomplished on their own, and that is found again in the words, the giving is described as the grace of God that had been given to them. Now, what that means then is if at the heart and foundation of all giving is grace, that means only a believer really knows how to give. And it also points out that Christian giving is much different than the United Fund or the Red Cross or something else. Those things are not, per se, the results of the grace of God. Christian giving is. So Christian giving is unique in that it is motivated and enabled by God's grace. As soon as he notes that these churches had a blessing, namely grace, he then looks at their poverty. Verse 2. Now, the first thing to note is the example of generous giving is not the one we would expect. The generous givers were not those who had lots to give. The generous givers were those that had nothing to give. And that is when you come to the second verse, and he says, that in great ordeal of affliction, that describes their environment in which they lived, they had a great ordeal of affliction, their abundance of joy, that's the spiritual quality that was there in the midst of that affliction, and their deep poverty, that's their environment, overflowed in the wealth of their liberality. So notice the emphasis is twofold. The emphasis is, number one, on their environment. And the environment in which they find themselves is described as affliction and poverty. And you would think that these two environmental problems that they have, namely affliction and poverty, would hinder and hamper their spiritual growth and their spiritual qualities. But notice that in the midst of the affliction, it brings forth joy. In the midst of the poverty, it reveals their liberality. So that instead of the things in the environment hindering them, they actually help them. And again, that has behind it the spiritual principle, which is of great importance, and that is this. The circumstances with which we are surrounded need not be any help, or any hindrance, rather, to Christian growth. So that the affliction did not diminish the joy. The poverty did not diminish the liberality. In fact, it gave them as an opportunity to express these things. Now, we mentioned in our last study that the word deep poverty is interesting because it's made up of the word te, followed by the word kata, preposition kata, followed by the word bathos or bathus, plural, followed by the word tokea. And that all gets translated by two English words, and that's unusual. Usually, you have more words in the translation than you do in the original. Well, this is one of the unusual places where the translation is shorter than the original. And the word ta, te, is the word the. Kata is the preposition that means down. Bathos means deep. Tokeia, tokos, was the Greek word for a beggar. And so it's poverty. And thus you're facing the translation, the down deep poverty. And perhaps it would be better to even translate it literally like that. But the idea is rock bottom poverty. They couldn't be poorer than they were. They're down in the depths. Poverty is the idea. Now, again, why would Paul select as the prime example of generosity people who are down to the very bottom in poverty? One thing for sure, they're commended for their generosity, and one lesson we can obviously learn from it is that not having anything has nothing to do with the quality of generosity. We can have the quality of generosity and have nothing as they did. Now, this will reveal then two things in the thinking of Paul in regard to giving. So let's just put a couple of concerns that Paul has on the matter of giving, and they'll emerge throughout the chapter. And they are, number one, In giving, it is not amount, but attitude. Paul is never concerned with the amount. Not amount, but attitude. These people gave. We have no idea how much they gave. There's not even a remote hint of the amount in any sense of the word. Paul is not concerned with that. He's concerned with the attitude. And in his teaching on giving in chapters 8 and 9, this will come through. A second thing, and we should get to it tonight in these verses, is his concern is with the relationship of what is given to resources remaining. His concern is the relationship of what is given to resources remaining. That is the same as the teaching of Jesus in the book of Mark, chapter 12, when you have the widow that gave the mite, but she gave all she had. You compare her total resources with her gift, and the mite or the gift matched the resources. That was all she had. That is giving. He points out that others came along and gave enormous amounts. But when you compare what they gave to what remained, they were still rich after they gave. And that is always going to be a concern of Paul in the area of the doctrine of giving. All right? We've got then their poverty or the circumstances from which they gave. And now a word about their generosity. Their poverty, and now their generosity. And Paul literally lets words stumble over themselves in verse 2 on the subject of generosity. Verse 2 says that in great a deal of affliction, their abundance, and just note mentally that word abundance, because we're going to come back to it and match it with another, their abundance of joy and their deep poverty, and tag this word, overflowed. And the first thing to note is the word abundance and the word overflowed, except for the grammatical form, is the same word. And if you would look up the word paraseia in a standard lexicon, the first meaning for the word abundance is surplus. And that is the same as the verb. So here's what he's saying. That in a great ordeal of affliction, their surplus of joy and their deep poverty surplused. So think of this. Here is a need. They meet the need with surplus. Then after they met the need with surplus, they came along and surplused the surplus. And therefore he is, as we said, falling over words. There is the need is met, and there's some left over, and then they take that which is left over and they add some surplus to what is already left over. So really what he's saying, they surplused the surplus. Emphasis on generosity of these believers. Now, in giving that way, they must have had some kind of standard, some kind of criteria, and that comes next in verse 3. What is their criteria? Their criteria is in verse 3. And let's basically state what it was. Verse 3 says, "For I testify that according to their ability and beyond their ability, they gave of their own accord." First, notice the criteria for giving, very simply, was this. The criteria was according to ability, and then some. I'll just put according to their ability plus more. And that was the way they looked at giving. Now that's expressed in the Greek New Testament real crisply. Notice the words, "I testify that according to their ability." The word "according to their ability" is simply the word kata, followed by the word dunamen. That is, and we'll come back to this in a second. Verse 3, I testify that kata dunamen, according to their ability, and para dunamen. So notice the two ideas are put together. Dunamen obviously is their ability, but the two phrases differ in the little preposition that goes in front of them. The first one is kata, and kata is a preposition used to introduce norm or standard by which something is measured or done. It's used to introduce a norm or a standard by which anything is done or which anything must measure up to. So Paul says, you determined what your ability was, what you could do, and you adopted what you could do with your as your standard. But that doesn't say it all. And you'd have to stop at that point and say, well, look, if they did all they could, what more do you want? Well, you really wouldn't have to ask for more, but they expected more of themselves, because the expression para dunamen simply is the preposition para, and it's to place something alongside. To place alongside. I would suggest something we use in English. They outdid themselves. That's an idiom we use in English, and it's a good one. So they looked at what they could do, and they did it. Then they outdid themselves. And again, keep in mind, these are people of deep poverty. Now, again, to show the volitional, generous spirit they had, we're not unacquainted with the fact that a preacher could so impress people or so con people that they would do some very stupid things with their money. It's done all the time. I'm sure there are many, many, many old folks who do not have much, but in the promise over the TV set that if you'll do this, God will shower whatever on you in terms of blessing, and many people have been conned out of what they couldn't give. Now, is this the case? Well, notice he closes that door and says that is not the case in the last part of verse 3. They gave of their own accord, one word in Greek, and it's a word that means wholly of your own volition. Without compulsion, without pressure from anybody else, it is strictly a volitional move. So, volitionally, they gave all they could, and volitionally, they then outdid themselves. And you normally ask, what would move them in that way? Verse 1. Brethren, we wish to make known to you the grace of God which has been given in the churches. There is nothing that motivates giving or living or conduct or anything else more than a grasp of the grace of God of tremendous importance. Now, because they were so poor, remember Paul had made a promise at the Jerusalem Council that he would, as he preached the gospel, that he would take up a collection for these poor Jerusalem saints. However, when Paul comes to the Macedonian churches, he never asks them for a nickel. And the reason he doesn't ask them for anything is because they were already in deep poverty. So since he doesn't ask them for a gift, what happens? They are going to beg him. The congregation took the offering. And so that points to the priority, which is next. But before we go to the priority, one other thing about verse 4. Let's go to verse 4. The entreaty. Not priority, I'm sorry. The entreaty is next. Verse 4. And again, this is set against the fact that they were not asked to give. Verse 4. He says, begging us with much entreaty for the favor of participation. Why did they have to do that? Well, the reason why they had to do it is obvious. Paul never asked them. And why didn't Paul ask them? Well, I take it verse 2 ought to be enough. I mean, he came to Philippi and Berea and Thessalonica, and he noted that they were all in rags. Most of them didn't have enough to eat, perhaps, and they were really stripped of all worldly goods. And Paul says, I just can't bring myself to ask these poor people for a gift, for giving. And so they are so moved by the power of God's grace, they say, Paul, please, let us participate. Now, what would make them do that? Begging us with much entreaty for the favor of participation in the support of the saints. So they had to ask Paul to please allow us to give, or they begged for the privilege of giving. Question, why would they beg for the privilege of giving? Well, the answer is wrapped up in verse 4 in the word favor. The word favor is the Greek word charis. The Greek word charis means, and you know it, grace. They're simply saying, look, we are not about to miss the joy of participating in grace giving. You're not going to take that away from us, Paul, and we fully intend to beg you to take our gift. Please do it. Don't let us, don't make us miss out on grace. And that, again, shows their orientation to God's grace. All right, after their entreaty, notice the next verse reveals their priority. Their priority is next. And that priority is found in verse 5. And this, not as we had expected, but they first gave themselves to the Lord and to us by the will of God. The word first is important because the word first carries with it two ideas. First of all, it points to sequence or order. Do this first, then do this. So chronology is very much in it. But the second idea involved in the word first is not just sequence 1, 2, 3, 4, but is the idea of rank or the idea of priority. This should occur before this occurs. Priority or rank. We use the word first the same way in English. Sometimes we mean, I want you to do this first and then do these other things. And we're emphasizing sequence or order. But probably the most common expression we have is Mrs. Reagan is the first lady. And it doesn't mean first in sequence. There have been none before her. It means priority, importance, rank is the emphasis. Both ideas are here. So notice what is this priority matter that ought to be first and ought to have a priority assigned to it. Well, this, not as we expected, but they first gave themselves to the Lord and to us by the will of God. So notice this. First, giving ourselves, we're looking at these two meanings now, giving ourselves precedes giving of money. Emphasis on the word precedes. Under the idea of priority, giving ourselves supersedes giving of money. Two ideas then. It precedes and supersedes giving of money. They had their priorities right, and this is the emphasis of this particular word. In verse 5, there is a word that you ought to note as an emphatic position. What do you think it might be? It is the word themselves. Emphatic word. So if we read the verse correctly, and this, not as we had expected, but they first gave themselves, actually the order would be themselves they gave to the Lord and to us by the will of God, in the sense that before they gave a nickel, they preceded it with giving themselves. And more important than the money they gave was the fact that they superseded that giving with the giving of themselves. Their priority is there. Now, from that, Paul is going to have completed the emphasis on the example of giving. And let's scroll all the way back to the beginning here. And notice we started out in the first 15 verses with the need for generosity. We have now had 5 verses giving the example. The example is Philippi, Berea, Thessalonica. They were moved by God's grace. Their deep down poverty did not hinder the grace of generosity. They were generous in the sense that they surplused the surplus. Their criteria is, let's find out what we can do and then add some to it, which they did. And since Paul had not bothered to ask them for money because they were so poor, they say, well, we're going to have to do something about it. He's not going to ask us to give, so we're going to have to ask him to please let us give. And the reason for asking that is we don't want to miss out on this, the favor of doing this, or we do not want to miss out on the grace of giving. And they conclude the example with their ultimate priority. Now, when you look at that, you would say, boy, that's powerful stuff, because the Corinthian church was not in deep poverty. They were not in affliction. This ought to be a really potent example. Well, it's a good example, but it's not the most moving one. We've got the most moving one yet to come. Paul is the kind of teacher who will convince you with a line of teaching. You say, boy, that nails it down. And they'll say, hey, hang on, I got one more in my pocket. And if you think that nails it down, let me show you the big guns and we'll really nail things down. So that's yet to come, but that will enter in now with our second point. And our second point, after the example of it, we go to the plea for it. It being generosity. Example of it, plea for it. 8, 6 through 15. I think it's very interesting that the reasons doctrinally for giving are set forth first, then he asks for it. He does not come on with a plea and then come along and attach reasons to it. It's not, Paul would never say this, we really need help for the Jerusalem saints and we want you to give and we want you to do so in a generous manner. Here's why. Not Paul. Paul never puts exhortation before doctrine. Paul's order, let's note that, Paul's order is always this. Doctrine first. Doctrine first. Then exhortation. And the reason for that is the exhortation rests on the understanding of good, sound doctrine. In fact, what book that Paul ever wrote wasn't built that way. When you go to the book of Romans, where do you go for the exhortations? The beginning of the book or the end? And it's the first 11 chapters that teach doctrine. Therefore, he will begin to teach doctrine. In fact, the typical order of Paul would be, and this is true in Ephesians, it's true in Colossians, it's true in Romans, it's true in Galatians, true in every book. It is doctrine and then the word therefore. And then exhortation. And you can take that little structure and you can place it over any book that Paul wrote and it fits every single time. The therefore simply shows that doctrine has implications. And the implications of doctrine are the way we ought to think, the way we ought to act, what we ought to do, and that is always, 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 always foundational. If Paul had had a youngster, he would have taken 45 minutes to explain the need of sleep for the human body and said, therefore, hit the hay at 9 o'clock. That would have been the way Paul would have presented it. And that, of course, is good, sound pedagogy. Any way around is to be sure that it's clear that what you're asked to do is not arbitrary. It has good, sound, solid reason behind it. And so we could put it another way. Every exhortation is backed with reason. There's reason for doing it, and we ought to add that that's an excellent way to discipline children. Not simply exhort and say, I want this because I want it, or do it because mom says for, or the bigger one yet, do it because adults always know best. And that really doesn't catch it. What catches it is sound reason, doctrine, and the therefore is just an easy step over into the next type of thing. Don't we all like, don't mind being exhorted about things we understand? When we're really taught, so yeah, I can see that what you're saying is reasonable, it's right, it makes sense, and this is the way Paul makes his exhortations make sense, by rooting them back in good, solid doctrine, and that is his order. So, coming on to chapter 8 and verse 6, in the plea for generosity, we have, first of all, the inspiration of giving. The inspiration of giving. Verses 6 and 7. Now, what we mean by that is this. The Macedonian believers gave generously, and in so doing, they inspired others to give. In fact, we're going to have a chain of inspiration forged right here that we'll see in these 6th and 7th verses. Now, how do we know that their giving was an inspiration? Verse 6. Consequently. And this points to what all of this is coming to. Consequently, we urged Titus. And the consequently points back to what the Macedonian believers had done. And as a result of what they have done, there's a consequence. We urge Titus that as he has previously made a beginning, so he would also complete in you this gracious work. And what carries the giving of the Corinthians back to the giving of the Macedonian churches? See the words, as well? We could put this way. So he may complete in you this gracious work as well as in them. So, as well are the words that links Macedonian giving to Corinthian giving. It links the Macedonian giving to the Corinthian giving. You are to do what they did as well. Now, notice, basically, when we talk about giving and the way it inspires, let's note, first of all, the triple benefits that comes with all material giving. Triple benefits. It's one of the rare things we can do that benefits so many different ways at the same time. Number one, it benefits the one who gives. It benefits the giver. How do we know it does? Remember Jesus' words? It is more blessed to give than to receive. So the first spinoff of generous giving is it benefits the one who gives. Obviously, the second point we don't need to dwell on, it obviously benefits the recipient. For obvious reasons. But that isn't all of it. When the giving takes place, it benefits the giver, it benefits the recipient, but it always has a spin-off to the third. And that is, it benefits others who have not been involved yet. Now let me show you the way that works out, or worked out in the chain. What has happened? The churches of Macedonia had given and brought benefits to themselves. The Macedonian churches had given and brought benefits to the saints at Jerusalem. Now, as a result of that, the Macedonian church not only blessed herself and blessed Jerusalem, they're about to bless Corinth by motivating them to give. Or, let's put it down, and I just have to read the chain reaction to get it right. Listen to it. The liberality of the Macedonian churches encouraged Paul to encourage Titus to encourage the Corinthians. You see the point? The giving of the Macedonians, step one, encouraged Paul. Paul was then encouraged to encourage Titus, and Titus went down to Corinth to encourage the Corinthians to give. A chain reaction of benefits that are involved in giving. And that's why we've called verses 6 and 7, very simply, the benefits of, or the inspiration of giving. Now, one other point. Christian graces are not complete if liberality is not among them. Verse 7. Can you see that? Paul's simply saying is you're not complete unless you're generous. And apparently the Corinthian church needed to work on that matter. So verse 7. Just as you abound in everything, in faith, utterance, knowledge, earnestness, and in love we inspired in you, see that you abound in this gracious work also. What is he saying? He's saying, I will grant that you have love, that you have faith, that you have utterance, ability to enunciate truth, you have knowledge, you are earnest, you have love, but hey, over here there's something missing. And until you get it, you're not complete. And thus, the emphasis that no spiritual qualities, in fact, that's another good lesson of verse 7. Can the presence of one spiritual quality compensate for the lack of another? And it's interesting, Paul is saying that can't happen. There's a hole over here, and you may have love and faith and utterance and knowledge and all of this, but there is something over here in your Christian character that is very much lacking yet, and you need to fill it in, and it's called generosity. All right? That's the inspiration of. Now, second, the proof of giving. Generosity is a proof of something. And that is found in verse 8. Verse 8 says, I am not speaking this as a command, but as proving the earnestness of others, through the earnestness of others, that is the Macedonian churches, the sincerity of your love also. I remember when I was in grade school, we went to Bales Baptist Church. And I remember looking on the balcony through, there's a rail about like that. I remember being high enough to look and see the platform through the rail. And over the sort of an arch up in front where there was the pipes of the organ. And on that arch, what was it? Remember? You got it. Okay, is this. You can give without loving, but you cannot love without giving. And that is the principle that Paul is saying. I'm going to check out your love. And the way I'm going to check out your love is by your giving. Your giving is going to prove how much you love. Now, question. When Paul says in verse 8 that he's not making this as a matter of command, why not? Did he have that authority? Well, Paul certainly did. He had apostolic authority, but I take it. The reason that he does not make this a command is very simple. He wants to maximize the Corinthians' opportunity to exercise volition directed by love. And Paul says, if I command you, it might get in the way of that. And I simply want to have the joy of seeing this, that I handle this in such a way that I maximize your opportunity to exercise your volition directed by love. And that is the proof that is given. Now, we're ready for the punch. We said that even though the Macedonian Christians were a powerful motive for giving, that we have not yet gotten to the supreme argument. So let's label verse 9, and you'll see it the minute you read it why we call it this. It is the supreme argument for giving. Paul is now at the conclusion, and he is ready to give us the very supreme reason for giving. Verse 9. Now you may be impressed by the Macedonian believers, but think about this. He says, for you know the grace of our Lord Jesus Christ, that though he was rich, yet for your sake he became poor, that you through his poverty might become rich. Now this is not a verse that is arguing that Jesus went around Palestine in rags. This is not what he's saying. It is true that the Lord said that the foxes have holes, but the Son of Man has not a place to lay his head. And while he was not rich, the argument is not that he went about in rags. The argument here is the incarnation. And thus, in his imagery, the being rich would be a reference to his pre-incarnate position in heaven. His pre-incarnate position in heaven. Being poor has to do with his incarnate position on earth. And the emphasis is not so much that he went about in rags. The emphasis is much, much bigger than that. The emphasis is that he was with the Father in his pre-incarnate state, and he gave up the riches of that, and he became poor. He took a body and he lived on this earth. The main verb in verse 9 is the verb became poor. We have said earlier the Greek word for a beggar was tokos. That's the word became poor. It is also important to note that, to really clear the air, that some people are beggars because they've made poor choices. Notice in the ninth verse that the verb became poor is active voice. It wasn't something that happened to him. It's an action that he produced himself. And thus he became poor, emphasizes that he was in no way forced to take up this position. He did not have to become poor. He did it volitionally in the fullest sense of the word. Now, notice also that this illustration of the incarnation begins with the words, "for you know." Now, if they already knew it, why repeat it? He is not saying, by the way, you folks don't know about the incarnation, do you? You're not aware of the fact that God the Son took a human body and lived on this earth. You didn't know that, did you? He says, you know that. So why would Paul repeat to them something that he openly acknowledges that they already know? And the reason for that, very simple, is this. It is one thing to know a doctrine, it is another thing to be able to relate it to the details of life. And Paul is taking something as big as the incarnation and relating it to something as simple as a collection for poor people, a collection for poor saints. And Paul is saying this, I know you know the doctrine of the incarnation, but I'm not so sure that you're linking it to the details of life. I don't think that you are really looking at those poor saints down in Jerusalem and you're thinking in your mind, I ought to get involved with this because of the doctrine of the incarnation. And so Paul is using doctrine in this way. And we, I think, could add to that that really the essence of maturity in the Christian life is ability to take the doctrine we know and link it to the details of life. And again, that was a minor detail in one way to a bunch of people down at Jerusalem that are hungry. Can you view a hungry believer doctrinally? Can you bring to bear the doctrine of the incarnation on that? And thus, again, I repeat, this is really the essence of it. Or let's paraphrase it one other way. He says, you Corinthians know the doctrine of the incarnation. Has it hit your pocketbook yet? Do you see that in his sacrifice of the supreme example? Now, the next thing that he moves to is the continuation of giving. The continuation of giving. And the continuation of giving is in verses 10, 11, and 12. And in verse 10, there are two things we need to focus on. Verse 10 says, I give my opinion in this matter. For this is to your advantage, who were the first to begin a year ago, not only to do this, but to desire to do it. So, in continued giving, what are the elements that you've got to have present for it? So let's just put elements necessary for consistent giving. They are, number one, there's got to be a disposition to give. You've got to want to. Got to be a disposition to give. And if there isn't a fixed disposition to give, then every time we get you to give, what are we going to have to do? We're going to have to light a fire under you. And Paul is saying, I want to see in you, and I do see in you, a fixed disposition that says we want to give. But wanting to give doesn't quite get the job done. There's got to be an act of giving. A disposition to give and an act of giving to complete the whole picture. Now, if you look at verse 10, as the verse closes, you have two infinitives. And the two infinitives, the first applies to the disposition, the act. The second applies to the disposition. Let's read the whole verse, and I'll point to them as we get there. And I give my opinion in this matter, for this is to your advantage, who were first to begin a year ago, not only to do, note that, to do this, but also to desire to do it. The word to do fits under the act of giving. The word to desire fits under the disposition of giving. They are both infinitives. The difference is this. To desire is a present tense infinitive. To do is an aorist tense infinitive. And so, the element that must be there, present tense, there must be a never-ending desire to give. And as you have that never-ending desire, there must be the little to-dos along the way. And so, with the opportunity existing, they see a chance to give and they do it. A week passes. The desire is still there. They see another one, and so they do it again. A little time passes, and they find another opportunity, and they do it again. It's a bunch of little dots, a little axe flowing out of an attitude. This is the act, this is the attitude. And that simply is going to mean what? That all they will need in order to give is to perceive the need. All they need to give is to perceive the need or the opportunity to do so. And therefore, that's why giving should be a low-key thing. If it has to be big, begging, then you wonder about the disposition. It's just like a girl who wants to go out with guys so bad. She really wants to do that. What's it going to take on his part? Lots of begging? No. Just say the time and place and we're on. And this is the way it was there. They had a disposition to give, and all they had to do was look out there and see the opportunity, and here it comes, because these two elements were present, and they're very necessary elements. Now, what is the meaning of the last part of verse 11? They apparently had started about a year ago to make a collection, and then something had happened, and they didn't finish it. So that's why he's talking about the continuation of giving. But now finish doing it also, that just as there was the willingness, a readiness to desire it, so there may be also be a completion of it by your ability. Now what does he mean by giving by your ability? Well, the next verse is going to take the words, by your ability, that close verse 11 and explain them in verse 12. The words, by your ability, are explained in verse 12. Now, what does that mean? Reading verse 12. For if readiness is present, and Paul is going to assume that that element is there, they were ready. If readiness is present, then it is acceptable according to what a man has. Notice the acceptability of the gift is dependent on how much you're worth, is the way we would put it, not on what he does not have. And therefore he's saying that if there is a willingness to give, that being the case, the gift is acceptable on the basis of what a man has, not what he doesn't have. Or we put it this way, God does not assess the value of the gift based on the actual amount. That doesn't make any difference. God assesses the value of the gift by comparing what is given with what is left. And notice the judgment of that is based on what a man has. What a man has would be total resources. And he's simply saying that God looks at your own ability, your total resources, and then looks at your gift. And from that comes an evaluation. Now, next, we just have time to introduce this. After the continuation, it is the emphasis on the equality of giving. And that is in verses 13 through 15, and that will complete our first paragraph on the need for giving. Now, notice Paul begins in verse 13 by saying, this request for money, let me tell you what I don't want to happen. I do not want the poor people to be put at ease at your expense. It's very interesting that he is being considerate of the giver. Coming down to verse 13. And notice, by the way, what the request for giving is not intended to do is looked at from the standpoint of the recipient and then from the standpoint of the giver. Verse 13. For this is not for the ease of others. The ease of others would be a reference to the Jerusalem saints. And for your affliction. In other words, Paul is simply saying, I do not want to inflict a hardship on you in Corinth in order to put the Jerusalem saints at ease. Now, in these words, you've got, and coming down to 13 and 14, for this is not for the ease of others for your affliction, but by way of equality. And notice that in verses 13 and 14, you have the word equality twice. Verse 14 says, at this present time, your abundance being a supply for their want, that their abundance also may be a supply for your want, that there may be equality. Now, when we come to that, we're going to take some time to do something that I think is very important at this point. Because you ought to, when you look at this thing about equality, you ought to begin to hedge a little bit if you are aware of what goes on in the world today, because there's a very evil form of thinking. And it is called agrarianism. Agrarianism, simply we've seen take place south of us over the last years. Agrarianism is basically redistribution of land. And by force, you come in, or the government, or some force, powerful force, comes in and says, you are sitting on top of the world, you've got thousands of acres, and we're going to march on your parcel of land, and we're going to redistribute it to the peasants. That is evil to the core. And it may make the liberal titillate a little bit, but it is evil to the core. Now that comes across in a little different way, where the force is not military so much, and the wording is different. Have you ever heard not of agrarianism or redistribution of the land, but the redistribution of, you supply it, wealth? Basically, how does your wealth get redistributed to the poor? Taxes. An army doesn't march and at gunpoint take your money. It's more subtle than that. We are taxed out of it. And this is where I want to pick up and deal with the following, and we'll make 7 points of comparison between what is the difference between redistribution of wealth and the doctrine of biblical equality that is taught here. And may I say, when we will chart them, 7 points down each side, you will find that the contrast is absolute. There is no connection between redistribution of wealth for the poor and the doctrine of equality as far as the Scripture is concerned. There is no point of comparison whatsoever, and we will see what comes forth in the biblical doctrine of equality that is radically different at least 7 different points than redistribution of wealth or liberal socialism, or ultimately communism, really is. They have nothing in common whatsoever. And we will make that comparison in our next study. Father, we're thankful tonight for your word. We're thankful for its balance. We're thankful for that which it teaches us. We're thankful for the example of the Macedonian Christians who were so sacrificial and generous. And yet we're thankful for the example that eclipses every other example.
and that is your Son who left the riches of glory to take a human body and die for our benefit so that we might partake of the riches of heaven through Him, for which we give you thanks tonight in His name.